Chapter 51. His rooms to and fro, staring down at his bare feet, his arms hugging his sides tightly. He would dream of Father Beeren sitting at the end of a long black table, behind which, in a row, appeared the heads, shoulders, and epaulets of the military members, nibbling the feather of a quill pen, and listening with weary and impatient scorn to the protestations of some prisoner calling heaven to witness of his innocence, till he burst out, "What's the use of wasting time over that miserable nonsense? Let me take him outside for a while." And Father Beeren would go outside after the clanking prisoner, led away between two soldiers. Such interludes happened on many days, many times, with many prisoners. When the prisoner returned he was ready to make a full confession, Father Beeren would declare, leaning forward with that dull, surfeited look which can be seen in the eyes of gluttonous persons after a heavy meal. The priest's inquisitorial instincts suffered, but little from the want of classical apparatus of the Inquisition. At no time of the world's history have men been at a loss how to inflict mental and bodily anguish upon their fellow creatures. This aptitude came to them in the growing complexity of their passions and the early refinement of their ingenuity. But it may safely be said that primeval man did not go to the trouble of inventing tortures. He was indolent and pure of heart. He brained his neighbor ferociously with a stone axe from necessity and without malice. The stupidest mind may invent a rankling phrase, or brand the innocent with a cruel aspersion. A piece of string and a ramrod, a few muskets in combination with a length of hide rope, or even a simple mallet of heavy hard wood applied with a swing to human fingers, or to the joints of a human body is enough for the infliction of the most exquisite torture. The doctor had been a very stubborn prisoner, and, as a natural consequence of that bad disposition, so Father Beeren called it, his subjugation had been very crushing and very complete. That is why the limp in his walk, the twist of his shoulders, the scars on his cheeks were so pronounced. His confessions, when they came at last, were very complete too. Sometimes on the nights, when he walked the floor, he wondered, grinding his teeth with shame and rage, at the fertility of his imagination, when stimulated by a sort of pain which makes truth, honor, self-respect, and life itself matters of little moment. And he could not forget Father Beeren with his monotonous phrase, "Will you confess now?" reaching him in an awful iteration and lucidity of meaning through the delirious incoherence of unbearable pain. He could not forget. But that was not the worst. Had he met Father Beeren in the street after all these years, Dr. Monaghan was sure he would have quailed before him. This contingency was not to be feared now. Father Beeren was dead. But the sickening certitude prevented Dr. Monaghan from looking anybody in the face. Dr. Monaghan had become, in a manner, the slave of a ghost. It was obviously impossible to take his knowledge of Father Beeren home to Europe. When making his extorted confessions to the military board, Dr. Monaghan was not seeking to avoid death. He longed for it. Sitting half-naked for hours on the wet earth of his prison, and so motionless that the spiders, his companions, attached their webs to his matted hair, he consoled the misery of his soul with acute reasonings, that he had confessed to crimes enough for a sentence of death, that they had gone too far with him to let him live to tell the tale. But, as if by a refinement of cruelty, Dr. Monaghan was left for months to decay slowly in the darkness of his grave-like prison. It was no doubt hoped that it would finish him off without the trouble of an execution. But Dr. Monaghan had an iron constitution. It was Guzman Bento who died, not by the knife thrust of a conspirator, but from a stroke of apoplexy, and Dr. Monaghan was liberated hastily. His fetters were struck off by the light of a candle, which, after months of gloom, hurt his eyes, so much that he had to cover his face with his hands. He was raised up. His heart was beating violently with the fear of this liberty. When he tried to walk, the extraordinary lightness of his feet made him giddy, and he fell down. Two sticks were thrust into his hands, and he was pushed out of the passage. It was dusk. Candles glimmered already in the windows of the officers' quarters round the courtyard. But the twilight sky dazed him by its enormous and overwhelming brilliance. A thin poncho hung over his naked bony shoulders. The rags of his trousers came down no lower than his knees. An 18-month's growth of hair fell in dirty gray locks on each side of his sharp cheekbones. As he dragged himself past the guardroom door, one of the soldiers, lolling outside, moved by some obscure impulse, leaped forward with a strange laugh, and rammed a broken old straw hat on his head. And Dr. Monaghan, after having tottered, continued on his way. He advanced one stick, then one maimed foot, then the other stick. The other foot followed only a very short distance along the ground, toilfully, as though it were almost too heavy to be moved at all, and yet his legs under the hanging angles of the poncho appeared no thicker than the two sticks in his hands. A ceaseless trembling agitated his bent body, all his wasted limbs, his bony head, the conical, ragged crown of the sombrero, whose ample flat rim rested on his shoulders. In such conditions of manner and attire did Dr. Monaghan go forth, to take possession of his liberty. And these conditions seemed to bind him indissolubly to the land of Costaguana like an awful procedure of naturalization, involving him deep in the national life, far deeper than any amount of success and honor could have done. They did away with his Europeanism. For Dr. Monaghan had made himself an ideal conception of his disgrace. It was a conception eminently fit and proper for an officer and a gentleman. Dr. Monaghan, before he went out to Costaguana, had been surgeon in one of Her Majesty's regiments of foot. It was a conception which took no account of physiological facts or reasonable arguments, but it was not stupid for all that. It was simple. A rule of conduct resting mainly on severe rejections is necessarily simple. Dr. Monaghan's view of what it behoved him to do was severe. It was an ideal view, insomuch that it was the imaginative exaggeration of a correct feeling. It was also, in its force, influence, and persistency, the view of an eminently loyal nature. There was a great fund of loyalty in Dr. Monaghan's nature. He had settled it all on Mrs. Gould's head. He believed her worthy of every devotion. At the bottom of his heart he felt an angry uneasiness before the prosperity of the Santome mine, because its growth was robbing her of all peace of mind. Costaguana was no place for a woman of that kind. What could Charles Gould have been thinking of when he brought her out there? It was outrageous. And the doctor had watched the course of events with a grim and distant reserve which, he imagined, his lamentable history imposed upon him. Loyalty to Mrs. Gould could not, however, leave out of account the safety of her husband. The doctor had contrived to be in town at the critical time, because he mistrusted Charles Gould. He considered him hopelessly infected with the madness of revolutions. That is why he hobbled in distress in the drawing room of the Casa Gould on that morning, exclaiming, "Decad, Decad," in a tone of mournful irritation. Mrs. Gould, her color heightened, and with glistening eyes, looked straight before her at the sudden enormity of that disaster. The fingertips on one hand rested lightly on a low little table by her side, and the arm trembled right up to the shoulder. The sun, which looks late upon Sulaco, issuing in all the fullness of its power high upon the sky from behind the dazzling snow edge of Higuerota, had precipitated the delicate smooth pearly grayness of light, in which the town lies steeped during the early hours, in two sharp-cut masses of black shade and spaces of hot, blinding glare. Three long rectangles of sunshine fell through the windows of the sala, while just across the street the front of the Avellanos house appeared very somber in its own shadow seen through the flood of light. A voice said at the door, "What of Decad?" It was Charles Gould. They had not heard him coming along the corridor. His glance just glided over his wife, and struck full at the doctor. "You have brought some news, doctor?" Dr. Monaghan blurted it all out at once, in the rough, for some time. After he had done, the administrator of the Santome mine remained looking at him without a word. Mrs. Gould sank into a low chair with her hands lying on her lap. A silence reigned between those three motionless persons. Then Charles Gould spoke, "You must want some breakfast." He stood aside to let his wife pass first. She caught up her husband's hand and pressed it as she went out, raising her handkerchief to her eyes. The sight of her husband had brought Antonia's position to her mind, and she could not contain her tears at the thought of the poor girl. When she rejoined the two men in the dining room after having bathed her face, Charles Gould was saying to the doctor across the table, "No, there does not seem any room for doubt." And the doctor assented. "No, I don't see myself how we could question that wretched Hirsch's tale. It's only too true, I fear." She sat down desolately at the head of the table and looked from one to the other. The two men, without absolutely turning their heads away, tried to avoid her glance. The doctor even made a show of being hungry. He seized his knife and fork and began to eat with emphasis, as if on the stage. Charles Gould made no pretense of the sort. With his elbows raised squarely, he twisted both ends of his flaming mustaches. They were so long that his hands were quite away from his face. "I am not surprised," he muttered, abandoning his mustaches and throwing one arm over the back of his chair. His face was calm with that immobility of expression which betrays the intensity of a mental struggle. He felt that this accident had brought to a point all the consequences involved in his line of conduct, with its conscious and subconscious intentions. There must be an end now of this silent reserve, of that air of impenetrability behind which he had been safeguarding his dignity. It was the least ignoble form of dissembling forced upon him by that parody of civilized institutions which offended his intelligence, his uprightness, and his sense of right. He was like his father. He had no ironic eye. He was not amused at the absurdities that prevail in this world. They hurt him in his innate gravity. He felt that the miserable death of that poor decade took from him his inaccessible position of a force in the background. It committed him openly, unless he wished to throw up the game, and that was impossible. The material interests required from him the sacrifice of his aloofness, perhaps his own safety too. And he reflected that Deckard's separationist plan had not gone to the bottom with the lost silver. The only thing that was not changed was his position towards Mr. Hollard. The head of silver and steel interests had entered into Costaguana affairs with a sort of passion. Costaguana had become necessary to his existence. In the Santome mine he had found the imaginative satisfaction which other minds would get from drama, from art, or from a risky and fascinating sport. It was a special form of the great man's extravagance, sanctioned by a moral intention, big enough to flatter his vanity. Even in this aberration of his genius he served the progress of the world. Charles Gould felt sure of being understood with precision, and judged with the indulgence of their common passion. Nothing now could surprise or startle this great man. And Charles Gould imagined himself writing a letter to San Francisco in some such words. ... The men at the head of the movement are dead or have fled. The civil organization of the province is at an end for the present. The Blanco party in Sulaco has collapsed inexcusably, but in the characteristic manner of this country. But Barrios, untouched in Cayta, remains still available. I am forced to take up openly the plan of a provincial revolution as the only way of placing the enormous material interests involved in the prosperity and peace of Sulaco in a position of permanent safety. ... That was clear. He saw these words, as if written in letters of fire upon the wall at which he was gazing abstractedly. Mrs. Gould watched his abstraction with dread. It was a domestic and frightful phenomenon that darkened and chilled the house for her like a thundercloud passing over the sun. Charles Gould's fits of abstraction depicted the energetic concentration of a will haunted by a fixed idea. A man haunted by a fixed idea is insane. He is dangerous, even if that idea is an idea of justice. For may he not bring the heaven down pitilessly upon a loved head? The eyes of Mrs. Gould, watching her husband's profile, filled with tears again. And again she seemed to see the despair of the unfortunate Antonia. What would I have done if Charlie had been drowned while we were engaged? She exclaimed, mentally, with horror. Her heart turned to ice, while her cheeks flamed up, as if scorched by the blaze of a funeral pyre consuming all her earthly affections. The tears burst out of her eyes. Antonia will kill herself, she cried out. This cry fell into the silence of the room with strangely little effect. Only the doctor, crumbling up a piece of bread, with his head inclined on one side, raised his face, and the few long hairs sticking out of his shaggy eyebrows stirred in a slight frown. Dr. Monaghan thought quite sincerely that Deckard was a singularly unworthy object for any woman's affection. Then he lowered his head again, with a curl of his lip, and his heart full of tender admiration for Mrs. Gould. She thinks of that girl, he said to himself. She thinks of the Viola children. She thinks of me, of the wounded, of the miners. She always thinks of everybody who is poor and miserable. But what will she do if Charles gets the worst of it in this infernal scrimmage those confounded Avellanos have drawn him into? No one seems to be thinking of her. Charles Gould, staring at the wall, pursued his reflection subtly. I shall write to Holrud that the Santome mine is big enough to take in hand the making of a new state. It'll please him. It'll reconcile him to the risk. But was Berrios really available? Perhaps. But he was inaccessible. To send off a boat to Cayta was no longer possible, since Satillo was master of the harbor and had a steamer at his disposal. And now, with all the Democrats in the province up, and every Campo township in a state of disturbance, where could he find a man who would make his way successfully overland to Cayta with a message, a 10 days' ride at least, a man of courage and resolution, who would avoid arrest or murder, and if arrested would faithfully eat the paper? The Capitas de Cargadores would have been just such a man. But the Capitas of the Cargadores was no more. And Charles Gould, withdrawing his eyes from the wall, said gently, "That Hirsch. What an extraordinary thing. Saved himself by clinging to the anchor, did he? I had no idea that he was still in Sulaco. I thought he had gone back overland to Esmeralda more than a week ago. He came here once, to talk to me about his high business and some other things. I made it clear to him that nothing could be done. He was afraid to start back on account of Hernandez being about," remarked the doctor. "And but for him, we might not have known anything of what has happened," marveled Charles Gould. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.